This edition of Ideas and Issues was recorded on location in Nashville, Tennessee. Your host is Hugh LaFollette from the Department of Philosophy at East Tennessee State University.
My guest this evening is John Siegenthaler, Chairman of the Freedom Forum First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt University. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
What I want to do is, first of all, I'd like you to get you to tell the listeners a little bit about the Freedom Forum First Amendment Center, a little bit about how it began, what its purposes are. Actually, before we do that, tell us a little bit about your background, specifically in the news media, because I think it's relevant to this discussion.
Well, first of all, it's great for you to have me on your program, old friend. It's good to be with you. I, as you know, was a journalist for 43 years. I began as a cover reporter with the Tennessean. Stayed in journalism until 1960, left in 1960 to spend a few months in the campaign of President John F. Kennedy, and after that went into the administration as administrative assistant to his brother, Robert Kennedy, who was Attorney General of the United States at the time. I spent about 15 months in the administration, in the government, then returned to the Tennessean as its editor, later became its publisher, finally its chairman and CEO. For the last 10 years of my career, I commuted between Nashville and Washington, where I was also USA Today's editorial director. I was the founding editorial director of USA Today and enjoyed that experience, too. The nice thing about commuting between Nashville and Washington is when they needed me at the Tennessean, I always said I was on my way to USA Today, and when they needed me at USA Today, I said the opposite, and so for 10 years, the staff ran both newspapers, and I didn't have to worry about much.
That sounds good.
I founded this center, which is funded by the Freedom Forum. That's the former Gannett Newspaper Foundation. The Freedom Forum is the foundation that is dedicated to free speech, free press, free spirit. We have worldwide offices, one in Hong Kong, another soon to be opened in London, still another in Buenos Aires. In this country, we are at the Media Studies Center in Columbia. We're at Vanderbilt here with our center. And our major headquarters is in Washington, D.C. The Freedom Forum World Headquarters is in Washington, D.C. And we're basically committed to helping people in this country understand and appreciate better the values embodied in the First Amendment. And then with our world offices to try to help in places like Eastern Europe, in Asia, some places in Latin America where freedom is in jeopardy, helping those parts of the world to create an appreciation, understanding of those values so crucial and so precious to our own democracy. And that's basically what we do and what we're about and who I am.
Okay. When you say you want to get Americans to appreciate the values embedded in the First Amendment, I mean, are Americans not... Do they not appreciate those
values? I think not only are Americans not appreciative of these great gifts we have from our founders, but more importantly, if you look at recent polls of editors, you find that a phenomenal number of journalists don't have any deep appreciation of the First Amendment outside those protections that they enjoy in the press. I mean, you know, religious freedom is in jeopardy in this country. And you don't get people in the media worried about, not many of them worried about, are fighting for those freedoms. The right of peaceable assembly in this country at times is in jeopardy. The media doesn't seem very much concerned about those. Very few editorials on that subject. The same on the right of petition. You know, lobbyists cause abuses in this country, but lobbyists most often are the people who exercise the right of petition, as they have a legitimate duty to do. And, you know, we have laws that punish lobbying abuses, but you know, special interests range in this country all the way from corporate interests, which in my judgment belong at the bottom, to consumer interests, which most often in my lexicon of values belongs at the top. And people who speak for both those interests and all those in between speak with the same protection that the news media speaks. Finally, the whole question of speech, whether it's symbolic or whether it's political or whether it's artistic, all of that speech deserves the protection of the First Amendment. And here I find, particularly where it comes to other areas of the media, the movies, the television, the radio, here I find news media people flake out most often and aren't willing to accord to others in the media the same rights that give them the protection to function. So I think that that we do try to help the media understand what the First Amendment's about. Beyond that, it's most important that people in this country, ordinary citizens, understand that these rights belong to them. I recently, maybe I'll just stop right there.
Well, let me ask, I'm not sure if it's the exact direction you're going to go, but what percentage of the people in this country do you think could even tell you what was in the First Amendment?
Well, it's 45 words that really embody those values I just enunciated. Religion first, not more than speech, press, petition, and peaceable assembly. But I had a recent seminar here on something called slap suits. Now, if I ask most people in this country, they don't have the slightest idea of what a slap suit is. It's a recent invention. Citizens who go to their local city council or to their local government to stand up and protest things like dumps in their neighborhoods, like plants that cause problems for air and water pollution. If they go in to object to zoning because there's going to be a mall put in their backyard or a prison in the next block, quite frequently now I find that corporate entities sue them just because they stand up in a public forum and raise general hell about what's happening to their neighborhood. Well, they don't have money to defend themselves. They don't have money to hire lawyers to defend themselves against a libel suit. It has a great chilling effect. There have been hundreds of slap suits filed across this country in the last 5 years. As I say, a relatively new phenomenon. And ordinary citizens who stand up to exercise their rights, ordinary citizens who really criticize the media for exercising its rights, are now finding that their rights are being threatened. And those people need to understand the First Amendment protects them. They need to know that there are ways that they can help defend themselves. 90% of the slap suits that are filed are dismissed after answer is filed by the person who's been sued, which shows you how frivolous these suits are, but they have a terribly chilling effect on the right of ordinary citizens to speak out and protect themselves. That's just one example.
All right, so the average citizen says to themselves, even if the suit will be dismissed, I don't want to go to the trouble of being sued. I don't want to have to hire a lawyer to defend myself, so I just won't complain.
That's right. And if a neighbor does complain and gets hit with a slap suit, it chills everybody in the neighborhood. I don't want to join with them. I don't want the dump in the neighborhood.
Right.
But on the other hand, I own this house, and I can't afford to have some developer take my house away from me because I spoke out against him, got hit with a libel suit. And, you know, newspapers, most of them, have libel insurance. They can afford to get sued. It's costly to hire lawyers, but they do have insurance. Ordinary citizens don't have insurance. They need to understand that the media, in quite a number of those cases, is their best resource in terms of getting protection. Because if they can get the media to expose the problem, then most often the developer doesn't sue the news media because the developer knows it's going to be very costly for them to hire lawyers to go through that long suit. And in the first place, there's no libel involved. It's just citizens exercising free, honest expressions for which there are frivolous suits filed to try to cut their voices off.
Okay. So here's a case where an individual's freedom of speech is actually going to be protected by the freedom of the press. The two freedoms, in a sense, work together.
That's exactly
to the same
right.
end.
Another area where it happens every day is in the area of freedom of religion. The courts in recent years have ruled in ways that make ordinary citizens, citizens particularly who have religious beliefs, it's a more even playing field. We've taken a very, very close look at this. School prayer amendment to the Constitution is now a great controversy burning in this country. I think if most people knew what is now permitted by the courts inside schools, there would be a different reaction on the part of the public. You are allowed to teach about religion as long as you don't try to proselytize and teach religion. We have a scholarly study here underway that's designed to try to help people understand that they can teach about religions. All of the state school districts in California have adopted our plan on this, and the President of the United States and Secretary of Education just about a month ago adopted pretty much the policies that we have recommended with regard to teaching about religion in the public school, which is permissible. And they don't understand now that the courts have held that if there is a secular meeting held after school in the public school system, then if a group of students want to have a religious meeting, they're entitled to the same rights that a secular group would have. There is more balance, there is more fairness. The other problem, of course, is that the media does very little in terms of covering religion in this country. It's getting better in a few places, but you would think that the media, I mean, there are more people who go to church in this country, more people than go to football games. More people go to church, give to their church in this country than give to anything except Internal Revenue Service. And the media treats it like a stepchild. It gives business a better break in covering business, education a better break in covering education, certainly gives sports a better break in covering sports. And so if the media would get on to itself and help the society understand what issues are involved here where freedom of religion is concerned, both those people who have a denomination and those who have none, those who believe and those who don't believe, could get fairness. And our policy here is to promote that idea of fairness so that people of all religions and people of no religions understand that schools are not the place for an enemy, where an enemy has a stronghold, not the place where you should litigate, but where people should go and learn, and our policy is to try to help them learn.
Okay. Well, I want to come back and discuss this issue of freedom of religion. It's clearly very important and a very contentious question. But I want to pause briefly for the benefit of any listeners who might just have tuned in. I'm Hila Follett. This is Ideas and Issues, and I'm talking this evening with John Siegenthaler, chairman of the Freedom Forum First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt University. And we're talking about the First Amendment. When you talk about this difference between the ability to teach about religion in the school without proselytizing, could you say a little bit more about that distinction? Because I think that's fairly important.
Sure. I was downstairs in our seminar room one day last month, and we had teachers in who are learning how to do that. And Dr. Charles Haynes, who is a scholar here, was leading that discussion. It was interesting to me to hear teachers from here and elsewhere stand up and say, I didn't know that I could say that. You know, one case that was recently brought in the courts was brought because a teacher told students to write an essay on a matter of great importance to them. And this student was flunked because he wrote an essay on Jesus. And the parents went to school and went to court and sued. Now, that's a suit that just didn't have to be brought because that teacher thought that he was doing exactly what the Supreme Court had ordered him to do, not to let a student talk about or get up and read a paper on Jesus. That's not what the court had held, not what students are not allowed to do. One of our recent publications is a parent's guide on what you can do and what you can't do under the Supreme Court's rulings. And we have put out a more extensive guide called Finding Common Ground so that teachers can understand what they can do and what they can't do. I think that all of the tension and all the litigation that now is raging in this country over this issue, virtually unnecessary. And the effort to amend the Constitution of the United States, I think, is virtually unnecessary. I mean, if anybody thinks that schools are going to be rid themselves of drugs or crime or guns or dirty language on the bathroom walls by getting kids to pray in the morning, they're kidding themselves. The truth of the matter is, if we were allowed to teach fairly about all religions, if we were able to trace the religious heritage of this country, of all religions, we'd come to a better understanding of what the country is about. We're stripping ourselves a vital part of our history by ignoring the fact, for example, that the first Jews who came to the United States came to New York and were denied the opportunity to practice their religion. Second group came to Rhode Island. Roger Williams was there, and they were allowed to practice their religion. Now, they weren't very trustful of Roger Williams. They built a trap door in their synagogue so that if there was a raid, they could all save their lives because Jews had been persecuted and they came from a background of persecution. Well, you know, that's a perfectly legitimate thing for children to hear and learn and understand. They need to know why the first Jews weren't allowed to practice, why the second were. The religious tolerance legacy that Williams left us became part of our national heritage. They also need to understand what the controversy is about, why people who don't believe don't want their children taught religion in the public schools. All of that is perfectly acceptable. You can teach that without proselytizing anybody, and when you don't teach that, you, as I say, you deny students the opportunity to learn about religious life in our country. I mean, right now, the fastest growing religious group in this country is Muslim, and we'd better get on to that and better understand something about that religion, because there are many elements of it that are not that far removed from what we believe in Christianity. I mean, and still they quite frequently, because of the misrepresentations of the media, people come to understand that the word that goes with Muslim is terrorist. I mean, which is an outrage to identify any religious group in that way. Well, I probably talk too much about this, Hugh, but basically our effort is to try to raise the level of understanding and appreciation of the people of this country. And we've gotten great national coverage. Last week, the Parent Teachers Association sent out 30,000 copies of our Parent's Guide on this subject. But I think I'll just stop there, and perhaps you want to move on to something else.
Yeah, it would probably be fascinating to spend the whole time talking about freedom of religion. But let's move to other areas and talk about freedom of speech. Perhaps this goes back to one of the things you said earlier, that newspaper editors, newspaper reporters are very protective of freedom of the press, but somehow they're disinclined to think about freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the right to petition, and so on. It may be a tendency on the part of most of us to be more interested in what we see as affecting our interest and not as able to envision what it would be like to be someone else, to be in someone else's shoes. Maybe the same thing is true of freedom of speech. We don't want someone telling us what we can and can't say. But I suspect most of us, at least some of the times, find ourselves wanting to say, yeah, but you can't say that, if we happen to find it offensive or if we happen to think it's at odds with what we believe. What has been your... Well, I mean, does that seem generally right? How do you understand the current problem with freedom of speech?
Let me give you the whole issue of hate speech right now is a burning issue across the country, and especially on college campuses. I was on a panel not too long ago with two very distinguished professors, both of whom are feminists, who said that really it was impossible to deal with the issue of hate speech. They were concerned particularly about outrageous speech that offended women, but they were also worried about speech that offended minorities and gays. I said, you know, we will tell you that the campus is not the appropriate environment to permit, to tolerate this sort of speech that demeans women, demeans African Americans, demeans Asians, demeans homosexuals, and therefore we need for laws to be passed to punish hate speech. Well, you know, I said in response that if it could, if you, within an academic year, or a four-year college experience. If the idea of answering hate speech with more speech and better speech, if you couldn't sell that on the college campus, there was no possibility to do it on the assembly line, no possibility to do it in the executive suite, no possibility to do it in the newsroom, no possibility to do it on talk radio, if you can't deal with hate speech on campus by debating it, condemning it, damning it, pointing out the evil of it. I mean, if you can't answer Minister Farrakhan's spokesman when they come on campus and attack Jews and homosexuals and Catholics, then if you can't do it in the college community, there is no chance of doing it anywhere. And so our plea and hope is that wherever hate speech is uttered, it be that the First Amendment will be used by others to respond to it, to put it down, to condemn it, to brand it for what it is, hate speech. And I just tell you, I don't believe you can lose that debate. But good people have to be willing, first of all, to tolerate it, and then to respond to it. And that's our way of doing it. The problem on the other side to you is that if you don't do that, then somebody's going to make judgments about what you're not permitted to say. I mean, there are people in this country who believe homosexuality is a sin. And if you cut them off from their right to say that, you deny a deeply held conviction. Now, I think they're wrong about that, and I don't think it's their business, but they believe it's their business. Now, if you cut that speech off and punish that speech, you really drive it underground. You don't change the people who feel that way about it. You don't give other people an opportunity to hear the full debate on the subject. And if it's true in that area, it is true of political freedom. It's true of artistic freedom. And this society does not need to be afraid of controversial ideas. We don't need sterility of the mind. We need creativity of the mind. And when you begin to say, we can't teach that here, we can't allow that utterance to be heard here, we need to stop the Nazis and skinheads, we need to stop G. Gordon Liddy and get him off the air because he said, shoot an IRS agent in the head, don't shoot him in the chest, he wears a bulletproof vest. I mean, that's an outrageous thing to say. But if you decide you're going to cut Gordon Liddy off from saying that, then where does it ever end? And Gordon Liddy had absolutely no intention of urging anybody to say that when he made that outrageous statement. I mean, I don't believe in anything G. Gordon Liddy says except his right to say any damn thing he pleases, and then I want the right to respond to him.
Okay, so the what you don't want is you don't want it to be prohibited, you don't want it to be punished by law. But on the other hand, you want people to stand up and say, that's outrageous.
Absolutely. The First Amendment's there for all of us, and all of us have to exercise it if democracy's going to work.
Okay. And in some sense, if we don't say it to G. Gordon Liddy, if we don't say it to people who engage in hate speech, then indirectly we're also damaging, undercutting the very value of the First Amendment.
Absolutely. Now, an awful lot of people say to me these days, listen, Rush Limbaugh is an outrage. Every day he attacks President Clinton, and I don't like it when we have somebody attacking Rush Limbaugh. I know how to hush Rush. You take your hand and you reach out and you turn the dial. And if you get somebody else you don't like, you turn it again. And if you can't find anybody you like, turn it off. And that solves the problem. You don't have to listen. And then find a forum and say, let me tell you what I did. I dealt with Rush. I hushed Rush. I turned him off. And that's the way, in a free society, you deal with it. You hush, tell him to hush, and then if you hear whatever he says and disagree with it, tell all your friends. Rush Limbaugh is full of it. I mean, he is launching unfair, unwarranted attacks on President Clinton. I'll tell you, Rush Limbaugh expects that. He knows he's in the marketplace of ideas. Same's true of G. Gordon Liddy. Now, from my political perspective, neither one of them has anything to say that I want to listen to. On the other hand, I sure don't want to deprive anybody else who disagrees with my political ideas. I don't want to deny them the opportunity to hear him, because they think he's funny, they think he's meaningful, they think that that he's got the answers. And so my view is that more speech would be a big help, and also for people who don't like what they hear, just not to listen to it, and to say that they're not listening to it, and to encourage others not to listen to it.
Okay. Actually, we're about to run out of time. Let me ask you this, though.
It's 28 minutes gone.
Yeah, we've been going.
What a speedy program you had.
Well, that's because you have such wonderful things
to
say.
Well, you have to come back to Vanderbilt, and we'll do it again.
Okay. One real quick question. I mean, there's a sense in which what you've been urging here is not just about what the government shouldn't do. The government shouldn't stop people from engaging in free speech. You've also been making a plea for what individual citizens should do. That is, don't sit in our duffs, get out there and say what we want to say in whatever form we can, and not just allow other people to engage in free speech, but to engage in it ourselves. Is that correct?
That's the price of democracy. And the founders didn't expect us to be people who didn't vote, people who didn't speak, people who didn't say what they had on their minds, people who didn't publish, people who didn't stand in the streets peaceably assembling in dissent against whatever they thought, people who didn't petition the government when they thought the government was wrong. I mean, that's what those 45 words about, and they're as precious today as they were when Madison forced them on the first Congress of the United States.
Okay. I've been talking this evening with John Siegenthaler, Chairman of the Freedom Forum, First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt University, and as you can tell, we've been talking about the First Amendment. Glad to have you with us, John.
Great to be with you again, Oldfield.
Good evening. This has been Hewlett-Follett for Ideas and Issues.